Hello, my name's George Halliday. I'm an awkward sod because my Halliday is spelt with all A's and everyone still wants to call me Halliday, but I'm a H-A-L-L-A-D-A-Y, Halliday. I became interested in journalism when I was in the sixth form at Lydney Grammar School. I'm a Londoner by birth, but lived in Gloucestershire for a long time. Point about it was, in the sixth form, we used to have these talks, and there was a journalist from the Gloucestershire Citizen, or the Gloucester Citizen, who came to the school and talked about his job. And then we all, a party of us, all went toddling up to Gloucester, having a look around the offices of the Gloucester Citizen, and I then thought, well, this is interesting. I was going to go in the RAF. I wanted to be a pilot or navigator, but in the end, because I failed a maths exam and was asked to come back again, I thought, well, I don't know, see how it goes. So I wrote a letter to miss this journalist at the Citizen and said, you know, could I do any work, little bits and pieces? And he wrote back and said, yes, I could. So I used to go round fetes and things for him. And then one day when I was living at Beachley, news came that a Richard Dimbleby was getting on the ferry boat and driving across to us. He'd been down in the area for, I think, one of his programs. So I jumped on my bike, got on the ferry boat and sort of introduced myself to him, and we did an interview, or I did an interview. And then I wrote my copy up, phoned it through to this journalist's wife, who took it down, and thinking, oh, that'll be a nice gossip column for his weekly piece in the Gloucester Journal. Much to my surprise, when it came out, it was not all about Richard, well, it was all about Richard Dimbleby, but it was about a young schoolboy who was very keen on journalism, interviewing Richard Dimbleby. So that was great. Felt chuffed for about 6 minutes. And then, surprise, surprise, a little while later, he contacted me and said that there was a job going on the South Wales Argus. Would I be interested in training as a journalist? So I said, yes. So I thought, well, I gave up the chance of going in the RAF. I thought, well, never look a gift horse in the mouth, and I might fail that exam again. So I became indentured to the South Wales Argus. I remember my having to take my father along in the end to have all these the papers signed. And I started work, believe it or not, on February the 25th, 1962. And I was told that I would be going out with senior journalists and they would be showing me how to do this and how to do that. But of course, we soon discovered that there wasn't enough journalists to go around. So in the end, I was going out on my own. And things like, oh, George, do you know how to write an inquest? No, I don't. Well, look, have a look in the paper. Here's how an inquest's written. That's how we do it. And that's how I learnt the craft. And in those days, most people weren't on the telephone, certainly not in Monmouthshire. And of course, being a journalist, you had to go out banging on doors to get your stories. It's something that doesn't seem to happen very much these days. But there we are. I used to go around banging on people's doors, and for a time I spent up in the Pontypool area of Monmouthshire as a district reporter, and then went to various night schools on law, etc. And then sat my old national proficiency certificate exam, which I passed, and immediately I passed, I was called up. I had to do my national service rather late. And I thought I was going to get away with it, but I didn't. So I spent two years in the RAF as a secretary to a group captain at RAF Northwood, which was then headquarters of Coastal Command, which is, alas, no more. And while I was there, well, another thing I was always keen in those days to get stories was that Marilyn Monroe was coming to England to make a film called The Prince of the Showgirl with Laurence Olivier. And I found out that they were, where they were staying, or where she was going to have a press conference, which was quite an experience. I rang up the PR people at the hotel and said, could I come along? I've got my NUJ card. Yes, come along. And I came along, and along with about 300 other journalists, saw the magnificent Marilyn come through the doors, and everyone was going, ooh, ah, and all that sort of thing. And I asked a couple of questions to her, including, she was saying, for instance, I'm looking forward to coming around England while I'm here. And I said, Miss Munro, does that mean that you will be coming to Wales? Well, she'd never heard of Wales and obviously looked very puzzled and said, well, if I can get there in a weekend, I will. So I filed this story through to my South Wales Argus the following morning. It made a page lead in those days, and it was taken up by I think at least several of the nationals, maybe one. And I then, when my national service was over, I returned to the South Wales Argus and stayed there for a few more years before moving on to Berrows Group in Worcestershire, and then finally, after a couple of years, coming down to Bristol and working for the Western Daily Press, which I was for quite a few years, and then I'd had enough of it and went into public relations because the money was better and I got a free car. And then in the end I went to work for a client, which didn't go very well, so I came back into journalism and back to the dear old Western Daily Press after a stint on dear old HTV writing news bulletins. And then when I retired, which is getting on for, it's in 90, I'm 73 now, I said, can I stay on doing work? And I was writing property, and they said, yeah, carry on as long as you like, which I am still doing at this very moment in time.
Now, what about the union? Did you start as a member of the union right at the very, very start, or was it something you were persuaded to join after a while?
I heard about the National Union of Journalists. And the interesting thing about it, the deputy editor, who was a great rugby writer as well, J.O. Davis, they were talking about the NUJ, and I said to him one day, because he was the chief sub as well, oh, I'd like to join the NUJ, Mr. Davis. To which he said, well, we'll have to see whether you're worthy of that, lad, yet. So I had to wait a little while, and then after a bit they said, yes, you're worthy. So I became a probationary member of the NUJ in the days when you paid 10 shillings a year. And of course, what I did, I used to go to the monthly branch meetings of the Monmouthshire branch, which apart from the, I think, a couple of the summer months, were held in the Murringer House just across the road from the Argus, in a room above the bar. And one of my tasks, being a, I don't say a creepy crawly, but I was the youngest one, I would get the beer in for everybody. And then we never had a quorum until everyone was saying, where's Harry Hopkins? Now, Harry Hopkins was one of those old guys who's a bit like me now. He was the old sage of the office. But dear old Harry would not come across to the NUJ meeting until he'd heard the Archers. And the, I think it was on Radio 2, and then he wouldn't come or even leave the office until he'd heard the news headlines. But I would always be sent over to say, can you come across, Harry? We need a quorum. And he'd say, I'll wait. And we'd have to wait, and then he'd struggle across. He was very poorly bad. He was bad on his feet. But he would come across, and then we could start the meeting officially. And the dear old meeting was great fun, really, because a lot of the subs were also lineage barons, and on Saturday afternoons I discovered that they would go over to the same room and just milk what they called the South Wales Argus Greenan of all the copy they could and send to their respective papers. And one of my tasks, which I don't think you'd hear of today, was I would have to go over with Mr. J.O. Davis to the Newport Rugby Ground. And there I would sit to phone copy through. But not copy to the South Wales Argus, because he had a direct line and his copy was taken down by a copy taker. In fact, in shorthand, every football report had to be taken in down in shorthand, because the editor insisted on having a copy in case there were mistakes, which did delay things. But I would be filing copy for him and his colleagues on the subs table to the various national Sunday newspapers with on the what they call fixed time calls. And I go down into this place below the stand, waiting for phone calls to come through from Manchester and everywhere and dictate these various stories through. I didn't get paid a penny, but the experience was quite good because I virtually saw half the rugby match for nothing, and the rest of the time I spent phoning copy through.
Were there any particular journalists that you worked with or editors that you felt were really influential and taught you a lot about the profession?
Yes, I suppose in a way the one that sort of influenced me greatly is a chap called Eric Price. And Eric Price was the editor of the Western Daily Press. Now, there's quite a lot of people who know Eric Price. They've called him all sorts of names over the years, but I learned a lot from him. In fact, what I had to do was to completely unlearn everything I'd been taught about journalism, because his idea of journalism was totally different. He used lots of four-letter words. He would call people this and that. You know, you were a... and this is crap, and he'd say worse words than that. And there were cases when this dear chap, when we heard of one chap who turned up for an interview and was met by a Western Daily Press sub who was going home on a train or something like that, and said, well, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to have an interview for the Western Daily Press. So he told him a few home truths, and the man immediately turned round and got back on the train and never turned up at the office. But Eric, and I'm still in... still in contact with him, he taught me a lot, because I realised that if he was like that in Fleet Street, because he'd come from I think the Daily Express, I thought, well, if he's like that there, are they all like it? So I had a pretty low ebb in my time, because the reason we came to Bristol was because my wife and I, we lost our first child when he was 8 months old, and I was feeling very low, and I thought, crikey, I can't be putting up with this, people at the end of the phone shouting and screaming down. At least I could have an up and downer with Eric face to face, and I knew that the following morning all was forgiven, and it was another day's work. But he did teach me a lot, and you know, I remember once saying to him, when I couldn't stand being a sub-editor any longer, he asked me why. I said, because I can't stand your shouting. To which he replied, I don't shout. Well, I'm not very much, and, you know, I don't mean it. I said, well, yeah. And then he said, would you like to become a reporter again? And I said, yes, I'd love to be a reporter again. Well, he only had one, because the Western Daily Press had not long been taken over by the Bristol Evening Post, and all their copy was really... appeared, a local copy, was blacks of the Evening Post, which the subs, and there was only six of us, had to sub down and rewrite at great speed for the Western Daily Press. But he had one man who'd already been a sub and couldn't take it, and he'd become what they call the Graveyard Mythman. And that was the days when, in fact, we actually had a paper where I could come out and write a story at midnight, know it, go through the stone at 20 past 12, and appear in the paper the following morning. Unfortunately, today, that is not the case. But it was interesting, because I also said after a bit, I really got on very well with the old news editor, a wonderful chap called Norman Rich, who was a real Bristolese chappie and a great friend of mine. And I said to him, to Eric, oh, thank you, Eric. I said, I thank you so much for letting me come. I'm a reporter. And the great put-down line for me was, that's all right, lad. He said, I thought it was the best thing for the newspaper. And anyhow, I stayed a few more years. And in those days, we used to get bonuses. Not quite as much as the linotype people, but we did have bonuses. And one year, I'd been working my guts out, and I didn't get a bonus. So I thought, sod it. So I went into public relations. And that's another part of my career.
Were there any stories in your early days that you felt it was really exciting to be involved in? I mean, you mentioned the Marilyn Monroe.
Well, yes, I can remember that. You know, the royal visits. I meant trooping up the valley to see the Duke of Edinburgh, wandering around Ebbw Vale and places like that. They were all quite interesting and fascinating for me, because everything was new, one was keen. The interesting facet about the early days, and you don't every you go to a court, and every court case had to be reported in the Argus on the insistence of the then editor, who I worked with, a chap called Kenneth Loveland. So you know, whereas the Echo would come in, the South Wales Echo would come in, and he just pick one story and file it through. Whoever turned in court, I mean, there was quite a few of them, we'd have to write about Charlie Brown riding his bike without lights, committing a public nuisance. And I think one of the funniest ones I ever did was the poor chap, he was dying for a leak in a very late at night in Pontypool, and he couldn't find a gent's toilet. So he thought, oh, there's a nice wall just around there. And he ran up a sort of, he thought was an alleyway, and had a good pee. Unfortunately, it was next door to, it was the police station wall. And despite his plea to the court that he couldn't see it, find a toilet open, I always remember they fined him 5 shillings. That's the sort of thing one did. And then the other interesting thing is because I started to show an interest in agriculture, I became the agricultural reporter of the South Wales Argus, which eventually led me on to the Burroughs Group in Worcestershire, where I wrote, all the farming stories that they ever wanted.
Now, you mentioned that, briefly, the new technology and the way things have changed. What's some of the real effects on the way reporters work nowadays that have come out of that new technology? Or is it really, is it a leap forward, or is it steps back?
Well, in many ways, I meant working on a PC. In the old days, if you made a mistake in a story, you'd might have to rewrite whole folios and things. I mean, today, you just write, I can cut that out. I can put that paragraph here. I can switch that there. That's great. I think what is rather worrying is the fact that you write a story and there's no what I call corrector of the press to read the stories or the advertisements anymore, and quite honestly, there's so many things can go wrong. Fortunately, it's the sub-editor who has to read the story and read it all, and there's no one coming up after him and saying, is this correct? You know, do you mean 10,000 miles, or is it really 10 million miles to Hong Kong or somewhere? And they were good friends of mine, the correctors of the press. Another thing that I did when I was young, which I don't think people do today, was when I was on the Argus, I decided I wanted to learn a bit about every department in the place. So unbeknown to anybody, I used to, if I got a bit of time off, I'd go round the various departments. And I remember going to the linotype room and saying, oh, I'd like to see how a linotype machine works. And I was told, oh, you'll have to speak to the FOC. I said, who's the FOC? And he said, oh, the father of the chapel. But I didn't know that. I thought it was a religious thing at those days. I said, well, all right. And then I was directed to this distinguished-looking gentleman who was sitting in one of these linotype machines. And I said, I was wondering if you could possibly tell me all about the linotype machine. And bless his old heart, he spent about 20 minutes explaining what a linotype machine does and what they had to do. I heard about expanders and all these sort of things. I was quite interested. And I always remember saying, young man, he said, you're the first journalist who's ever come down here and actually asked about what we do for a living. And I went to the other ones, and you don't see them now. The processing department with the smell of fish glue and acid and thing, where they used to etch the photographs. It was great fun, and down into the print room to watch the old printing machines working and seeing how they went. I think it's a pity that maybe journalists are not shown around the other departments, and maybe the other people shown around the journalist department. But that's my personal point of view.
What about the ownership of the Western Daily Press? It's a paper that you've been on for a long time now. Have you seen changes in ownership, and how have you seen that affect the job at all?
Well, it certainly, you see, at one time the Bristol United Press was the Bristol Evening Post, which was set up, I think, in 1932 as a result of Northcliffe, I think, involvement in the city. So it was Bristol run and Bristol controlled. Somehow or other, the Northcliffe group got a stake in the Bristol Evening Post, and at the end was having about a 29% stake in the company, which included their pension fund. And I remember that after I'd arrived in the scene, there was an issue that cropped up, and there was an assurance given that they would never take the paper over. Well, you know, managements can change, and the decision was eventually taken that the management and the paper was taken over, which is a sad thing, because although now we're part of a great group, and whatever one thinks about great groups, at least you would just be assured, if you were a young person, that being in a big group, you've got the offers of opportunities of getting jobs and promotion in other areas if you're prepared to move. But you see, in those days, the directors were Bristolians, the Hawkins family were greatly involved with the paper, and it's now just part of one of many newspapers in a vast group owned by the Daily Mail. As a sort of pensioner or senior citizen, I don't really know what's going to happen. At one time, there was a moment when there was a suggestion that they were going to sell the whole of their provincial newspaper group off, but I see that didn't last very long. I think they discovered that there wasn't anyone prepared to pay what they wanted for it. What has happened in Bristol is that there's been cutbacks on staff and to save money, and I can understand that in many ways, but everything is controlled, we know, not now in Bristol so much as somebody else saying to people in Bristol, this is what you're going to do and this is the way you're going to do it.
For youngsters starting out in journalism, have you got any tips for them? Because this is the sort of thing that I think for many people, just coming straight out of a course into a practical newsroom, they're not quite 100% prepared.
No, I don't suppose they are. I think what they've got to try and do is try and get as much knowledge as possible. Do what I did. Ask. And so willing, in effect. Of course, other things have changed. You don't have to take copy anymore. I remember the days when, you know, the late night man, when the copy takers packed up, if you were on the graveyard shift, you were taking copy at midnight. Well, that's gone. Well, that's nothing wrong in that, but at least you got to chat with various people. I would say today newspaper, the industry is changing, it has to change, and in fact we're now becoming, there is a feeling that lots more people will read newspapers on the internet. Personally, I've tried it, I don't like it. I still like to have something in my hand where I can look at, see the headline, look at it, read it, and then come back to it again and again. And when, I don't know, I was naive, when I first heard about newspapers on the internet, that you just press the magic button and you see the front page of the Daily Telegraph or whatever it was, and you just home into it. But of course, it's not like that at all. Personally, I suppose today, if you're interested in media, is maybe consider going into broadcasting, because that seems to be the way. The only fault about everything is that there's too many people chasing too few jobs, and I don't, personally, on some of the salaries being offered these days, I don't think many of them will ever be able to afford to buy a home of their own.
Are there any other journalists over the years that you've built up a really good relationship with, and someone that you feel that, you know, you can sort of spend a bit of time with to compare ideas and that kind of thing?
No, I've had some good friends. I remember the one guy, when I first turned up in Pontypool, and I didn't know what was going on, and he was very, very helpful for me. I go back to his office and we go over the stories, and that was a chap called A.D. Ramsey. A.D. Ramsay was a great NUJ man. He eventually became the president of the National Union of Journalists, and he used to come to the Monmouthshire branch meetings and tell us what was going on at the National Executive. And when he went to London, he'd always say, George, in his wonderful Aberdonian accent, will you look after things for me? And I always religiously did. I go to courts, and whatever I filed for the South Wales Argus, I would file for the South Wales Echo. And on Sundays, I remember filing stories through for the Western Mail as well. And I never let him down, because he never let me down. And he was one man I greatly respected. And and another one was dear old Harry Hopkins, who was one of those characters who went to court. And in the days when divorce courts were reported, but you could only give the judges sort of summing up, he would never take a note in shorthand. And he would write it down from memory, until one day the editor decided that was dangerous ground, and they pulled him out of it. But what transpired, that Harry's father, I think, was a very good shorthand writer, and I was told worked for the Western Daily Prayer, the Western Mail. And I remember I was sort of doing my sort of exercises in the office with my shorthand, and he looked over my shoulder and said in his gruff voice, "You've got the yuk the wrong way round." And I thought, well, wait a minute, there's a man who's supposedly not be able to write shorthand, who knew I'd made a mistake. And I said, Mr. Hopkins, I thought you couldn't write shorthand. Well, he just laughed and walked away. The other interesting thing about the NUJ is, for a personal note, was that when I was in the doing my national service, I went to the 50th anniversary dinner at the Dorchester Hotel with my good old colleague Harry Hopkins, and we were the only two representing the Monmouthshire branch. And dear old Harry bought the beer, because he said, I'll buy the beer. So the wine waiter came round, and everyone else was drinking wine, and he said, "Do you have any draft beer?" And the wine waiter looked at him and said, "Yes, sir, we do. Would you like a jug of it?" So he said, "Yes." So when the bill came, it was, believe it or not, only 12 shillings and sixpence. But in those days, it was a hell of a lot of money, especially when I was earning only about 6 and 8 pence a day doing my national service. And he said, "Oh, I pay for that." And then he looked at the bill and said, "My God, if that's what they charge for the beer, I think what they must be charging for the wine." And then the day after I was demobbed, coincided with the ball, the NUJ 50th anniversary ball in the South Bank, on the South Bank, where my future wife and I got engaged. So I have a strong affinity with the National Union of Journalists.
Have you ever worked on a dangerous story where you felt, slightly at risk in part of what you're doing?
I can't think of, really. I suppose I've been a lucky guy. I mean, I've interviewed various people. I mean, I remember meeting Gordon Brown, when he was sort of unknown when he came to Bristol many years ago. Dear old Harold Wilson, who was in Bristol, I had to deal with him, and various other people, Edward Heath, in those days. We did everything, and in my time, I've become an industrial reporter, you name it, go to inquests, go to council meetings, doing the whole range of stories on all these different subjects. And what is surprising today, that nobody seems to go to council meetings anymore. So, you know, nobody really, when you pick up the paper, there's nothing about, you know, the tiddly little things that people are interested in, like, oh, you're going to have a new bus stop. I mean, those little things made little paragraphs, and the Evening Post used to do those, but of course nobody goes there anymore. You can't cover every court case, so really the chances of if you get caught doing anything, the chances of you being reported in your local newspaper is virtually nil.
How much do you think it matters, the fact that there's so much less political reporting in Bristol now and, you know, other parts of the country than there was in the past?
I think it's very sad, because the interesting thing about reporting political pieces, certain members of the Labour Party at one time didn't like the Western Daily Press and Eric Price for what he was writing. And I remember when I was doing industrial reporting, I went to have any words with me, and I said, well, look, give me a chance, give me a break. If you don't like what I do this time, then fair enough, I won't trouble you again. So I've forgotten the story, something to do with the buses and disputes, and I wrote this story up, and it was okay. And in the end, I was being told all sorts of things. And then, you can't come to the meeting, George, but if I meet you in a certain pub outside, you know, just across the road, I'll give you all the facts. And what I would do, he would tell me all the details, and I think, well, we can't write it the way you're doing it, I'm saying. Do you mind if I rewrite? Now, this is the way I know it will go in the paper. So I wrote it, and if he agreed, we got on fine. And we had lots of good stories, but today, I don't think there very few happen. Again, that's the way papers are going. It seems to be all features and stories that you can pick up without spending too much time.
Now, some people are a bit cynical about the union, saying, well, you know, it's just a little bit of legal insurance and it's hardly worth it. Do you think that the union has really made a difference over the years?
I think so. I mean, as I say, in those days, it was a privilege. And I remember telling some members of the NUJ once, which didn't go down very well, when I joined, I was vetted first before I joined, allowed to come into the union. I said, now any Tom, Dick and Harry seems to get in. And most probably it was not quite true. But yes, I think the NUJ has done a great job over the years. It's certainly helped an awful lot of people. And I hope it continues to do so. And long may it carry on doing so.
Can you tell us about some interesting local story with a bit of a political edge, George?
Yes, well, in the 1960s, the dockers and the Transport General Workers Union was very powerful in Bristol. And, you know, the dockers sort of ran everything in the docks. And if they didn't like things going on, they could bring the docks to a halt. But then there became an internal row, because there was a chap called Jack Dash who had a crowd, and they were trying, I think, to take over the dockers part of the union. And there was a right whole do's going on. And I remember somehow I got involved with going to a meeting which was reported in a report, a government report at the end, about a meeting was held by dockers in the Plume of Feathers in a place called Hotwell, Bristol, where a lot of dockers were meeting. And believe it or not, I was the only journalist invited to attend the meeting. And I remember the meeting was going on and someone said, is there any member of the press here? And I put my hand up and said, yeah, I'm here, Western Daily Press. And someone else said, that's all right, George is all right. So I was all right. And then another chap chimed up and said, I'm from the Daily Worker. I think it was called the Daily Worker in those days, for the Morning Star. And I thought, well, that's strange, I've never heard of this chap. But he was actually a worker at an engineering company called Strawn and Henshaw. And I met him, a funnier thing, part of the meeting, in the gents' toilet. And he said, you're not going to put my name in the paper, are you? He said, why not? I said, well, he said, you know, it affect my job at work. I said, oh, no, I won't do that. But I said, is it all right if I say a representative of the Daily Worker or the West was also present? He said, yes. And that did me a great favour, because he used to start ringing. He was an Irishman. He used to ring me up about all sorts of things. And once he said, rang up one night and he said, oh, by the way, we're having a strike at Strawn and Henshaw tomorrow. I said, oh, you're young. So I had the home number of the managing director of the company, which was, and I remember ringing him up and telling all of us, what about this strike? He didn't know anything about it. So I had to tell him, well, so we're going to have a strike tomorrow. But, you know, one thing I did learn, and I've always, don't let people down. And if you say to somebody, that's strictly in confidence or off the record, it is off the record. I've known journalists who play the dirty trick and then think for 2 minutes of glory that they'll drop somebody well and truly into it. The point is, if you're a provincial journalist, more than, and you want to keep your contacts because they're very local, the only way you can keep them is if they can trust you. So trust does play a great deal in one's career.
Have you ever had your work censored, or have you ever seen stuff censored?
Not to my knowledge, no. I have had occasion once when I had a story from a firm of Bristol solicitors who it was about property and it was pulled off the stone by the editor of the Western Daily Press, a chap called Terry Manners, because they were representing a member of the company who was suing for extra money or compensation for, I suppose, dismissal or something. And that's the only time it's ever happened to me that a story has actually been pulled, because the excuse being given at the time was, well, we're in dispute. Well, I suppose they were, because in fact they lost, the group lost the case, and the person was paid a substantial sum of money.